Paper Zero, Section 12, which is old single column, page 15. So, one last little bit of hyper-dense text to slowly pick our way through, and then we'll get into a little bit more open seas once we get into paper one. Matter of fact, we'll kind of get there by the time we get to the acknowledgement here. It's just this last section, we're still going to want to mine it for a little bit of its detail before we head on to the Father. I think we don't really need, you know, anything in the way of an intro besides, we've touched upon the experiential trinities a few times here as we've gone through these just immediately previous sections. So, here's where they officially are going to put down some of the details. You'll see, a lot of it is, kind of like what we said last week, they're trying to cater to the brand new reader, as well as there's always, subtle little details thrown in there for the super advanced reader as well. So, let's start.
Section 12, the Trinities. The original and eternal paradise Trinity is existential and was inevitable. This never-beginning Trinity was inherent in the fact of the differentiation of the personal and the non-personal by the Father's unfettered will, and factualized when his personal will coordinated these dual realities by mind. The post-Havana Trinities are experiential, are inherent in the creation of two sub-absolute and evolutional levels of power personality manifestation in the master universe.
Okay, let's notice a couple little things in there. Notice that very last little statement, based upon how we stressed it in the prior sections here. When they're talking about the two sub-absolute levels, but they're saying evolutional. So that's very, very definitively putting us way down at the bottom of the bottom-up point of view, the individuality viewpoint. They're going to start you, in very easy waters, or the easiest possible waters, to begin to think about this. Not even initially challenging you to try to think about evolutional and eventuational at the same time. So very bottom-up viewpoint. And in the middle there, when they start saying the differentiation of the personal and the non-personal, the coordination of those dual realities by mind, you're probably immediately thinking, a lot about, in the order they've got it, personal and non-personal. So you'd have the Eternal Son, the Isle of Paradise, and then, the Infinite Spirit. When you get to the mind part, but notice how they word that last part. They're trying to get you to not think just in that sort of immediately recognizable mode, even if you're a new reader. Because they say that by the Father's unfettered will and factualized when his personal will coordinated these dual realities by mind. Okay, so bringing in his, it's actually a little bit more on the deity absolute, unqualified absolute, universal absolute, for the three mode. And of course, even more so if you flip it around to the unity viewpoint, so that instead of thinking of the universal absolute, Yeah, it's the reservoir of mind, and so that fits in right, you know, immediately what they're saying. But for it to really think of it as part of the Father, and hence, under the control of His will, you really are thinking the infinite upholder. You know, you're taking the unity viewpoint on that. That component of the three elements there in that sequence. And then the other little thing, you know, when they say coordinated, okay, that's a mother keyword. See, and again, to take it all the way to thinking of it in terms of the infinite upholder as the, coming down to the absolute upholder, the absolute upholder, the finite upholder, those three levels of the mother. So, see, all of that is very subtly, woven in there. And then there's even one more little subtle thing. Notice how they purposely worded that beginning. It doesn't just say the eternal paradise trinity is existential. The original. Remember how we've now understand this, that when we talk about you have the potentials and the actuals, and then there's the original, and that original is not just the Father or the root of the Father. That's one side of the original. What's the other side of the original? The Paradise Trinity. See, so, that's not your first thought is, original, you're just trying to really stress beginning. No, it's a technical word, Always be looking for them to be disguising a technical word for a new reader, so the new reader doesn't stumble over it, so that it's too hyper-technical, on the first few reads. But once you get into it, the words are there so that you can, you can see all the details. So they're starting us off with the other side of the original, not the first center, the Paradise Trinity. All right, so what do they say about the Paradise Trinity?
The Paradise Trinity, the eternal deity union of the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit is existential in actuality, but all potentials are experiential. Therefore, does this Trinity constitute the only deity reality embracing infinity, and therefore do there occur the universe phenomena of the actualization of God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and God the Absolute.
Okay. Now, remember how a few sections back, they kind of said almost the exact same thing when they brought up the three absolute individuals, Universal Father, Eternal Son, Infinite Spirit, and they is existential in actuality, but all potentials are experiential. Remember how they said the same thing, and we pointed out, an obvious way to immediately begin to understand that is not just think about the facet of the Father that's called the Universal Father, but to think about all the facets of the Father, for instance, the Infinite Upholder, that's a reservoir, so there's potential there, so that experiential can come from that potential. And so, in your immediate bottom-up viewpoint that they're putting us in here to start out, you can go, so I guess I understand that. I've got the Father and the Son and the Spirit again, and I'm thinking of the super-additive consequence of the relationship between the three is the Paradise Trinity. So I guess some of that experiential potential gets woven into this super-additive consequence. But, especially when you start bringing in the word original, you're bringing in a top-down viewpoint. The challenge there then is to understand the Paradise Trinity being a potential, and hence, having experiential as opposed to just existential attached to it, from that top-down viewpoint. Not as a consequence of the union of the three. And that's very complex. And that's, again, beyond the scope of what we're going to try to do here in Friday night study group. That involves the co-infinite. Okay, that's going way, way into the most advanced picking apart of the details. But that's there to be recognized, for an advanced student as well. The very fact that they would say basically the exact same thing again, you're going, well, yeah, they already said that. Why would they waste space to say it again? They must be trying to tell me something different than they told me before. Yeah. See, so your challenge is to figure out, why is it there a second time? Because there's not just the bottom up, there's also the top down. So it's in there twice. Again, we brought up the original. And of course, we know when we're talking about the two sides of the original, what's the actual name of that facet of deity that we're calling the original? That's the universal one of infinity. The universal one of infinity. And what does it say? Therefore, does this trinity constitute the only deity reality embracing infinity? Right? It's the universal one of infinity. And maybe this is an opportunity to think a little bit again. You know, we've attempted different ways of understanding, visualizing these two sides of the universal one of infinity. One of the ways I've done it is, this is the Paradise Trinity side, and I think of it as just perfectly flat, and it's engaging every point of infinity. And then think of the other side as a single peak, extending out to an infinite horizon, on this side. And that point of that peak is the first center. Okay, so now think about it, a little bit further. The infinite one freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. He pulls himself out of infinity, but he still encompasses infinity. He's wrapped around infinity. And so he doesn't engage infinity like the Paradise Trinity does, where every single point of infinity, there's also a point of the Paradise Trinity. So the Paradise Trinity is within. He's without, but wrapping around it, touching it, the whole of it simultaneously. So he touches it as if it is one point, not an infinite number of points. And so when you visualize it like this, that first center, that's the one point through the Trinity via which he engages infinity. Okay? That's that one, condensing all of his engagement affinity to that one point, the first center. Okay. So that's the difference between how those two are participating in the universal one of infinity. One is as an infinite number of points, and one is just as encompassing it all as if it were one point. Okay, all right. So
that's why one is existential, the other is experiential.
Yeah. Right, and you can just imagine how, such an incredible touching every point of infinity, how that could have inherent in it, an experiential potential. It's no matter what happens in infinity, it's right there with it, intimately. See, so you can begin to sense how you might begin to understand that, and then. You might also notice the strength of this. They say that initial sentence, and you don't feel a huge dose of, wow, I've got to use the word therefore after I've read that, but they do it twice. Wow, what should I have understood out of that first sentence that I would go therefore and again therefore, as if there's something very much coming from this Paradise Trinity. So again, it's the original. One side is the root of the Father. What's the other side the root of? The Mother. know, and, you know, that hierarchical expression of the mother is what gives rise to God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and God the Absolute. You know, therefore, there is what you need to mother the three experiential deities into existence. You know, that's what the therefore is about, the mother, see, again. Okay, so that's, and again, just notice how subtle that is. You know, we've talked about this a million times now. You have to allow yourself to go, therefore, why would you put therefore in front of these sentences? I just don't, you know, and don't let go until you can find a resolution to that very purposely constructed curiosity they put in there. They're trying to get you to go beyond sort of what you can immediately grasp. They're trying to leave a loose end that if you are curious, if you're a truth seeker, you're not going to let go of until sometime, maybe 20 years down the road, you know, 21, like if you're me, you go, oh, I get it. That's what that's there for. You know, once you put the pieces together, then you start recognizing. You know, so that you can actually get that recognition response to the paragraph. You know what? That's what you're looking for. You've been very patiently trying not to start interpreting it because you haven't had a recognition experience yet. So you know if you got running off interpreting, you're just going to be putting new wine in old wineskins. You're just going to be creating some elaborate rationalization scheme that just reflects your limited starting point. You haven't been revealed to yet. You need to get that recognition point. Then interpret. Okay. You know, and it might be just as simple as recognizing that there's a curious therefore in there and going, oh, and I can interpret that. That's easy. I see what that's about.
For all right. Visitors, can I go through the four things? Discover, recognize.
Oh, yeah. Up in the Jesus Papers, you've got a very important sequence. Discover, recognize, interpret, and choose. Mm-hmm. Choose is in italics. Because they want to stress, do not use your personality to choose until you've gone through that sequence. And the most important thing is the recognize step. Do not skip the recognize step. You skip that recognize step and you just discover this book and proceed to interpret it with your old wineskin, you know, inside your old wineskins, and then start choosing with full absolute zeal. I mean, you're going to go flying off on false tangents.
That's page 2094.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Way back there at the back, yeah. But that's a very important sequence. Discover, recognize, interpret, and choose. Okay, so you can see even in these first little paragraphs, see they're weaving. It's just like we've been experiencing up to now, same kind of careful weaving of intro and advanced anchor point, you know, synopsis together as one text.
It's
really cool.
Unpacking
yeah.
Lots to unpack.
Yeah, lots to unpack. All right.
Next one.
Yep.
The first and second experiential trinities, the post-Havana trinities, cannot be infinite because they embrace derived deities. Deities evolved by the experiential actualization of realities created or eventuated by the existential paradise trinity. Infinity of divinity is being ever enriched, if not enlarged, by finity and absonity of creature and creator experience.
Yeah. That's all pretty straightforward, you know, giving you the nice pair to reflect on. You know, they introduced the two sub-absolute levels, and so right there together they put finity and absonity to introduce you, to get you comfortable with using those expressions to sort of talk about what's going on in those two domains, the domain of finity and the domain of absonity. And we saw how they used the absonity, remember, how they went philosophy and absonity, and starting to get you comfortable, or at least attempting to get you comfortable with thinking about, You know, there's first transcendence of science and religion, and the super additive consequence is true philosophy. But then you can challenge yourself to even go another notch up, even more transcendent. So transcendent, you might want to even start to say it has inklings of something fundamentally transcendent, like absonity as opposed to finity, you know, where you start to have moda in play. In other words, you know, you are beginning to engage the absoniteness of, you know, the absonity of now. You know, there's an absonity now as well as then, you know, post-grand universe settled enlightened life. That's why it's valid, you know, to use the word evolutional in talking about both. Because while you still have evolution going on, there is a, in parallel to that, there is a coordinated eventuation, you know, eventuating that's happening. That evolution is driving eventuation. It's not driving the eventuation of beings like the master or the architects of the master universe. You know, they were there before, but it's certainly driving. You know, if nothing else, getting you from a creator son to a master son, and a master son, you know, has a toehold in the absonite. You know, where did that eventuated absonite part of the master son come from? It didn't come top down, it came bottom up. It came as a consequence of evolution. It's a very literal, eventually all this evolution led to this much absonity. Okay, so, it's, you know, you might think that seems like a sort of a an odd little paragraph. It's like, well, that didn't seem to give me a lot in addition to what they've already said. But see, you know, they've never put those two together there. They're trying to get you familiar with thinking about these two domains together and, you know, and having an easy way of talking about them. After all, because we're about to really kind of, you know, we're going to have bullet point one and bullet point two. We're going to want to be able to have both of these things, you know, in front of us at the same time and think about them.
So does that mean that the current absonite is a manifestation of the current level of the finite reality?
In part, the bottom-up part of the absonite, but there's the top-down part as well, you know, and the two are coming together in a very definitive way in this first experiential trinity that we're going to read about.
Yeah. Trinities are truths of relationship and facts of coordinate deity manifestation. Trinity functions encompass deity realities, and deity realities always seek realization and manifestation in personalization. God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and even God the Absolute are therefore divine inevitabilities. These three experiential deities were potential in the existential Trinity, the Paradise Trinity, but their universe emergence as personalities of power is dependent in part by their own experiential functioning in the universes of power and personality, and in part on the experiential achievements of the post-Havana creators and trinities.
Okay, let's just pick a couple of things out of there. Notice that fascinating little starting point where they brought in truths and facts again. Okay, so trinities are truths of relationship. And so when we think of the of trinities in the bottom-up point of view, where we have some number of individualities or individuals that we are imagining and, you know, or picturing in association, and then there's a super additive consequence of that whole relationship, that's what we're talking about there. And just like when we were contemplating that fact truth pair that they had gave us a while back, and we have fact, truth, and goodness, you know, and it initially, you know, you're kind of thinking you're in a plane here, but, you know, more truthfully, you know, there's two endpoints, fact and goodness, and the super additive consequence of the relationship between those two, super additive, is truth. Okay, so see how the parallel there? So just seeing you taking all these fact points of these individuals, and there's a super additive flow that's a consequence of all them. There's a truth that flows through them all, and hence is super additive of the facts themselves. So that's, they're invoking that image there. So that's a bottom-up image. And then the facts of coordinate deity manifestation. Okay, that's the top-down point of view. And, you know, and you're immediately keyed by the word coordinate, you know, the top-downness of the mother, you know, and it's and the root, the, you know, the anchoring of the mother in the Trinity. You know, and that's why when you look at the functioning of total deity, you know, and what we normally call here the circuit of the mother, the second to the outer circuit, it's like, well, you know, it's actually two things. You know, it's the circuit of the functioning of the Trinity, and that is the root of the circuit of the functioning of the mother. So they're both there. The Trinity and the mother are together, you know, as a simultaneous expression. One being that non-personalizable root, and the mother being the personalization, you know, the deity that is personalizable, you know, as God the mother, at various levels, you know, is personalizable from that non-personalizable root. Okay, so, you know, it's a circuit of the functioning of the Trinity, and that's why you have all those words that describe the functioning of the Paradise Trinity, Trinity of Absoluteness, Trinity of Ultimacy, Trinity of Supremacy. You know, that's the functioning of the Trinity. You know, Trinity functions on all levels, and then through that universality of functioning comes the universality of the Mother. Or maybe not through, maybe from that universal functioning comes the, you know, universality of the mother. So, you know, it's just, and we've talked about this, you know, we'll jump ahead a little bit. You know, when you think about, you know, this first experiential Trinity, you can say the ultimate Trinity, that's the bottom-up expression, or you can say the Trinity ultimate. That's the top-down view, and that's where you're really just thinking of it as this one fact of coordinate deity manifestation coming down from above, as opposed to something that's a super additive, you know, truth-like consequence. Okay, so two sides there again, and then there's a we've gotten keyed to when we see Encompass, and one of the things, you know, like Gene was, you know, brought up a couple times last week, I think it was, you know, when you see Encompass, you know, you think, oh, is that mind? Yes, I mean, in the sense of, you know, if we're talking about from an individuality viewpoint and we have the universal absolute, the reservoir of, you know, potential for mind energy, you know, and that encompassing of mind, but we flip it around to the unity viewpoint, we have the infinite upholder and all of the hierarchical upholding, and so related all, you know, when you start talking about, the Trinity, the root of the mother, there's an encompassing, an encompassment that comes into play too, and we'll bring that up when we get to the very last paragraph of the section here. Just tie up that little loose end. How to, what they're invoking there, and by saying encompassment, it's a, you know, sort of the most advanced thing that you can start to bring in. Let's see, what else do we have there? Oh, let's see. I guess right there at the end there. Take an example. So we're trying to bring God the Supreme into existence, and, you know, and they're saying that the emergence as personality, as, you know, of the Supreme, of the Supreme Being as a personality of power, is dependent in part on His own experiential functioning in the universes of power and personality, So what are they invoking there? If we think of this supreme being, this personality of power, as a absonite individual, as a he, but down in the universes, instead of transcendent of the universes, but down in the universes, there's the Almighty Supreme and the Universal Mother. There's the power pattern component, and there's the personal purposive component. See, so they're invoking that. So you can think of part of what's going on as him down in. And then they say, and in part, on the experiential achievements of the post-Avona creators and trinities. For instance, when you're talking about bringing the Supreme Being into existence, you have that whole functioning of the Supreme Creators and the Supreme Controllers and the Sevenfold, that engine that through which you give rise to one facet of this directly, the Almighty. And if you take this up a notch, if you're trying to think about bringing the ultimate one into existence instead of the supreme one, like we mentioned, I think it was last time, there you sort of have this this initial foundation upon which you visualize all that happening of the ultimate Trinity. And so that's why they mentioned it. See, the Trinities are involved in this too, even in that bottom-up view. Because there, if you're going to have some analogous God the Supreme-like thing, some sort of an engine, that's really driving the bottom-up actualization of the ultimate one, but that's all predicated on the existence of the ultimate Trinity.
Does every actualization of God eventuate in a Trinity?
No.
Okay.
They're all going to be involved in sort of one way or another.
I mean, is God the absolute?
That's exactly where it's going to go. I mean, you probably remember, and we're going to read it in a second, that God the Supreme and God the Ultimate are involved in the second experiential Trinity, but God the Absolute, no.
Okay.
Yeah. There are, especially when you get up to talking about the Absolute and the Infinite, there's a lot of complexity there that's sort of involved in anchoring and initiation of this whole process that can lead to Trinities.
Mm-hmm.
And so that anchoring is not, is there to support the subsequent existence of Trinities rather than being part of the Trinities.
Yes,
okay.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. And not to mention there's always, obviously, who knows how complicated things are actually going to get when we get way up into the absonite. There's going to be all kinds of expressions of deity that we have no concept of now and stuff, but
you won't be one for absolute trinitization.
But it doesn't, but that's a good point. It does. It's not like trinitization is, that's the key. I can bottle everything up into sets of three, and then I've got it all sorted out. It's not quite that simple,
When they say in part twice here. That could mean that there's only two parts.
Yeah, well, it's because there's the top-down part and the bottom-up part.
All right, I see that.
Like I pointed out, they're kind of balling everything together here and kind of keeping it simple. Obviously, there's always some kind of top-down and bottom-up, and so you can talk about those two parts. Until you use your material consciousness to recognize, and delineate individuality, you don't have any actual potential for understanding relationship. If you just let your spiritual consciousness, be the first, middle, and last word of everything, it just looks at everything as one. It's just, not even really one, as unity. Just smears it all together, and there's no potential for understanding.
It doesn't take into account your individuality.
You're right. You've got to delineate, too. I mean, the whole reason that you would want to delineate so that you could understand the relationship, in other words, that there could be a relationship is that unity that's there. I mean, if there was no unity, once you separated, then they'd sit, island universes. You know, what could ever link them together if there wasn't some overarching unity? Okay. So obviously unity is important to the complete understanding.
Inherent trust that God can't be broken.
Right. But you've got to allow things to actually individuate. No matter how scary that is for your immature spiritual consciousness, you have to tell it it's okay. We're going to allow things to not all be unity yet. But it's okay because there's an infinite upholder underneath all of that unity. Nothing's going to fall. It's okay. Trust. Okay? It has no edges and no cracks. Trust. It'll be fine. Let it be individual. And now discover why there's individuality so that there can be something besides the I am, so that there can be true relationship. You know? Allow your universe to go beyond the I am state. You know, and the only way to do that is to temper your spiritual consciousness. It's like, no, I think I like the I am. Let's just let it all be one. You know, and it's nice and simple, and we're done. You know, imagine world peace. You know, it's like, well, there actually is individuality. So you can imagine it all you want, and it's not going to be there. Okay, you know, you have to get it there truthfully, which means you have to find the true way to connect members of a cosmic system together. And what is that? The individuality of the whole, the mother. All right. Okay. All right, so let's jump into and get the first trinity here.
The two post-Havana trinities, the ultimate and the absolute experiential trinities, are not now fully manifest. They are in process of universe realization. These deity associations may be described as follows. You want me to just carry on? Mm-hmm. Number one, the ultimate trinity, now evolving, will eventually consist of the supreme being, the supreme creator personalities, and the Absonite architects of the Master Universe, those unique universe planners who are neither creators nor creatures. God the Ultimate will eventually and inevitably powerize and personalize as the deity consequence of the unification of this experiential ultimate trinity in the expanding arena of the well-nigh limitless Master Universe.
Okay, all pretty straightforward. There is a fun thing there at the beginning, and this is a, you know, it's interesting to notice. You know, remind yourself, oh yeah, that's right. I am in the forward here. I'm not up in deity and reality or something. I'm in the forward, and I might be, you know, I might be writing for a, you know, if you're on this commission, I might be writing for a brand new reader. I'm hoping I'm writing for a brand new reader. You know, and they're starting the forward. And you know, we know that they're trying to gently ease you into these more complicated issues. It's like, okay, they're going to assume you've got some notion of God as Father. You know, you picked up something from the fourth epical revelation, what Jesus told us, that God is your Father. And you've read these previous sections, and they had the one about the Supreme Being, and you were starting to get the notion, I have, you know, the infinite Father, and then I have the supreme Father, the supreme being. And so, unlike, you know, normal, when we talk about the three components to this Trinity in the bottom-up point of view, they switch the order. They put the supreme being up front so that it's more immediately parallel to, you know, when, you know, they just introduced the Paradise Trinity. They put Universal Father, Eternal Son, Infinite Spirit. And that's the typical order you put those three in. And so they gave you a little gentle ease in and flip the order. So it's kind of in that same order. There's the Father-like first, the Supreme Being. And then they even, instead of saying the supreme creators, they even sort of, you know, use this other expression to really stress the personality. It's called the supreme creator personalities. And so it has even more parallel to that, you know, the absolute personality, the eternal son. And then there's, you know, there's the third one, which they can't help but have to, you know, introduce you to. It's like, whoa, what the heck is that? You know, and how's that parallel to the infinite spirit? It's not a creator or a creature. Okay. But at least I got the first two parts, I think, you know. Okay. So you see how they're easing you in by doing that. Now, when you begin to really understand it in a more definitive way, you wanted to put it in the order supreme creators, and of course, and controllers are in there, supreme creators, then the supreme being, and then the architects of the master universe, to put it in that order. And then it parallels the order that you have in the next experiential trinity. So let's read that one.
The ultimate trinity.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of cool when you think about it. It says, in the expanding arena of the well-nigh limitless master universe. So that just means that after this, they'll go on further even and create more universes.
Right. You've got the whole supreme thing is happening in the grand universe, and then, you know, in the master universe, you're going to have the ultimate phenomenon happening.
You need those architects out there to...
Right, and I'm glad you threw that in, because you just, you know, wait 1 second, and you just reminded me. I was going to mention, you know, something there, because we were talking about the, you know, the bottom up and the top down. You know, and here's, you know, you see it very definitively in this first experiential trinity. So you're initially, before you're thinking of the ultimate trinity as somehow being the way to get you all the way to, you know, the ultimate one, you know, the complete actualization, realization of God, the absolute. You know, just, you know, at the starting point of the absonite age, you're getting this trinity completed. And there's, you know, there's basically two parts to it, three parts technically, but, you know, there's a part that very, you know, the first two have a lot to do with what was coming up out of the finite, you know, and now is finally up to the absonite, all the supreme creators and the supreme being coming up out of the finite, you know, mostly. And then there's the architects, you know, that are just absonite beings. They have nothing to do with welling up out of the finite. They were created, you know, they weren't created, you know, they were eventuated, right, in the absonite as absonite beings directly, you know, on all seven levels of the absonite, okay. And so within that trinity, you know, you have both sides here. You know, the architects are, in terms of us, are always in this top-down projecting mode. Remember when we talk about, you know, using that word projected when you're talking about the architects? Because it's related to the infinite capacity, that type of deity. You know, their type of, the deity of their bodies, their selves, is absonite capacity. Okay, so you have these very, you know, top down related to the finite, and then you have then you have very, very bottom up, like you're thinking about a creator son going all the way up to a master son, and then you have some that are kind of close to the boundary, and some that are kind of on the boundary, really, because you've got the, you know, God the Supreme. You have to really understand God the Supreme. There's both a top down and a bottom up, you know, but it's all there, you know, some that's a lot bottom up, some that's kind of a little of both, and some that's very much top down, and it's all coming together to give you a starting point for the next stage when you look at it in that time viewpoint like that, ticking along. Okay, then you had a question.
Thanks. Yeah. With what Pam was talking about, it's well nigh limitless.
Yeah. And why is it well nigh instead of limitless?
Perfecting universes, right? But that expands the four outer space levels.
Right. But again, the whole master universe is big, but is it infinite? No. There's an outer boundary. The fourth outer space level has an outer boundary. It doesn't go to infinity.
What about the grand universe?
No, that's very limited. You know, that's just down here in the central and the super universe level. You know, so, but, you know, relative to the, you know, what is really an enormity of the grand universe, you know, from our little blob of protoplasm perspective, the grand universe is very, very, very big, okay? And But it's utterly negligible in size compared to the master universe, even in compared to the first outer space level, you know, radius of the first outer space level. You know, if you draw the first outer space level outer boundary like this, the dot in the center is the grand universe. You know? And if you draw the second outer space level, the dot in the center is the first outer space level. You know, I mean, they're just, you know, gigantically bigger. No, they already, I mean, no, and again, think about that. We tried to, earlier on, we tried to challenge that. They don't have to go anywhere. It's very important. When you think about the master universe is not just the outer space levels. It's the outer space levels and the grand universe. We are in the absonite domain here. The absonite domain isn't just out there. As a matter of fact, when we look out there, what do we see absonite galaxies? No, we see finite galaxies. And we see evolving matter. You know, we see an evolution that's going to eventually get to a starting point for the absonite age. I mean, so, you know, the whole master universe has an evolutionary foundation. Again, you know, we've been stressing that, using the word evolutionary for, you know, thinking about both. You know, very much the stage upon which that subsequent play is going to be enacted is evolving. You know, all of those galaxies out there, those millions and millions of galaxies, are finite, evolving phenomena that will eventually be a place for what's going to happen in the next age. You know, and so you have finite, you know, material evolution out there. You have finite material and personal evolution down here in the core, in the grand universe. But the whole thing is part of the master universe. And so all of that, personal and non-personal, is all giving rise to the beginning subtleties of the absonite. Right now. Here, there, and everywhere.
Our current physicists are impinging upon the absonite, and they don't know what it is, right?
Well, everything is impinging, you know. I mean, finite doesn't just float. You know, like I said, I mean, probably the best one is, you know, is the iceberg, you know. The iceberg is not just what you see above the water. Every iceberg has a part that's below the water. Every atom, you know, that part that you can see above the water, the thing we call an atom, you know, has something that's below the water, has an absonite root underneath it. I mean, every atom goes all the way down through all of the absonite right to the point where it's resting upon the isle, you know, the presence of the isle, you know, impinging upon the absolute. You know, if you think about it, all together is one. Like, what did I say? That one paragraph that's like, well, why didn't they just skip that one little tiny paragraph? Because didn't they waste some space? No, they wanted you to think about the finity and the absonity together in one sentence. Stop separating them so much. Stop taking such a simplistic time viewpoint. Everything that you do is the finite and the absonite at the same time. It can't be anything else. Okay? Every molecule in your body is both finite and absonite. You know, your personality is both finite and absonite, and it even has one dimension of the absolute. Okay, it's all together as one. And you start by understanding it in sequence. Then you start trying to think about it all together, and then you start to really take a unity viewpoint, a top-down viewpoint, and you start really letting go. Of that time viewpoint as being your sole means of understanding. You're not going to throw it out totally, but you're going to augment that time viewpoint with an eternity viewpoint. You know, and if you achieve that, not just with all this stuff, but with you, your understanding of you, now you've started to eternalize your consciousness. Now you've started to see yourself as already part of eternity now. And that's why you would go through all the effort to do anything besides just be. Okay? Because you're not just a little cork bobbling along with the second hand. You know, you're part of eternity now. Or at least you can be if you choose. And if you precede that choice by discovery, recognition, interpretation, okay, so that you wrap yourself around the infinite eternal ellipse, you make yourself part of infinity and eternity. You've been given the potential to choose that if you so choose. But if you don't, then you'll be as if you never were. But you can choose to not be just finity and temporality. You can choose to be part of infinity and eternity.
What I'm wondering is if we actually, when we spiritize and absonatize ourselves, when we look out there, will we see more than just that physical reality?
We're not going to see more than that until the Supreme Being reaches down and pulls us up into the absonite. Until that last moment of the finite age.
Okay, so...
You know, even all these very high finite beings, you know, and they peer through a telescope and they don't see anything that we don't, you know, different than we do. They just see finite evolutionary matter.
Okay, so what about the current...
The current transcendentalers? Who knows, who knows what they see? Because like we try to point out, you know, many times they actually speak about absonite spheres in the present tense instead of the future tense. And you're going, okay, that's hard to think about.
Well, transcendentalism, paradise.
Well, yeah, yes and no. it's all, the more that you let go of the pure time viewpoint and allow for the eternal, the more you have to try to wrap your mind around an imponderable, that all of the absonite and all of the absolute and everything already exists. You know, and I'm just experiencing up through it. It's all there. I'm experiencing up through it, and I have absolute free will. So it's not like my path up through it is predetermined. I can take any free will path, including taking myself off the chessboard, and being as if I never was. And it's all of the absonite and the absolute are still already there. You know, and you're going, well, how on earth could there be free will and the whole thing and no predestination? Mind. Because no matter what kind of a choice or decision that, you make down here in the finite, there's that which encompasses all that. There's mind that is wrapped around all of that and can adapt to anything. And that's an interface between the finite and the absonite. So, the absonite can be, and the finite can be, in a sense, independent, but there's an interface. The Supreme, God the Supreme, is an interface that keeps those two in constant balance. Despite all of the choice, the free will choice that's going on, they're still connected and there still can be a top down and a bottom up. And okay. Now, obviously, I don't completely understand what the heck I'm saying there. But you get the gist of it, to begin to allow that, to begin to try to wrap your mind around how there can be all of the absonite, and I can still have free will. Because if you can do that, you're getting yourself out of a very difficult old wineskin. One of the most difficult old wineskins to break yourself from in going to the fifth epical revelation. That's a real tough one, to allow the truth of free will and with no shred of predestination. It's obviously going to involve a serious reformation of thinking. You're going to have to work through everything that you kind of started to dot I's and cross T's on. It's like, well, no, wait a minute. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's step back and let's allow for all the truth that I currently have, but recognize what I have that I thought was truth, but it actually is error. It seemed like truth because I was taking too circumscribed a point of view. But the good news is, no matter how circumscribed your initial point of view, there's always room for a little measure of truth in there. It's probably going to have a lot of error, balled up with it. You know? But if you can expand your horizons a little bit, set that truth free, all of that error that you sort of had to have in order to have such a small boundary, you know, if you make the boundary bigger, some of that error just automatically evaporates. The truth is still there. There's room for more truth now. And, less error is required in order to butt up against this circumscribed boundary. And if you can just keep spreading that out, the error just evaporates as you expand. You know? And all the truth, the true truth, the actual truth, you know, is never lost. You know, even what that faint flicker had in its little tiny single-celled universe of, you know, understanding. Yes. Yeah.
Can you review for us what is meant by supreme creator personalities?
Yeah, supreme creator personalities or the supreme creators are, you know, if you bring up this chart about the sevenfold, the supreme creators are the bottom three levels of the sevenfold creators. The master spirits, the ancients of days, and, you know, when they're all completed and they're really master, you know, sons, you know, the master creator sons. You know, but initially you can think of it as the creator sons and the creative mother spirits, the ancients of days, and the seven master spirits. Those are the supreme creators. And then, you know, all of them have a complement on the power side. So there's the supreme controllers. Those are the supreme power directors and the supreme power centers and the master physical controllers. Those all together are the supreme controllers. So it's those bottom three levels of the sevenfold. Yeah. All right, let's go to the absolute Trinity here.
Two, the Absolute Trinity, the second experiential Trinity, now in process of actualization, will consist of God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and the unrevealed consummator of universe destiny. This Trinity functions on both personal and superpersonal levels, even to the borders of the non-personal. And its unification in universality would experientialize absolute deity.
Yeah, there's some absolute deity is experientialized. Some was existentialized. You know, the conjoint actor or the eternal son. Maybe just one little thing, because that's pretty much just kind of a straightforward statement. But just. To better understand why did they proceed consummator of universe destiny with unrevealed? It's like, didn't they just reveal it? They've got his name right there in black and white in front of me. They've revealed that there's a being that you can begin to understand via that designation, consummator of universe destiny. But what haven't they revealed? They haven't revealed exactly what type of deity he is, you know, and how he fits in precisely into all the details, but you could figure that out if you put the pieces of the revelation together, and that's why they gave you the name, so that once you start to put all the pieces together, it's like, oh, I see there's a being that's going to be this and this and this. You know, I need a name for that being. Oh, they already gave me a name, of course. That's the consummator of universe destiny. You know, all these things that they're, you know, the unrevealed, agencies of the ancients of days, creative agencies of the ancients of days, things like that. Whenever they have unrevealed and then they proceed to reveal it, you know, by name anyway, and some little context. I mean, it's not totally out of the blue. It's in some context here. They're saying, okay, here's one of your first challenge points. See if you can put together enough of the clues in the revelation. get it working for you in truth, not just a pile of facts that just sits there. Start getting some truth flowing through it. See where it takes you, and you'll immediately start to go. You know, start to see more of the picture, and you'll need names for this more complete picture. And you'll see we've already supplied you with most of the names you're going to need. And if we haven't directly supplied you with the name, once you get to that point of understanding that part of the picture, it'll be very obvious how you can take the names we have given you and coin names in parallel. Like, we've given you Infinite Upholder. It shouldn't take too much creativity to come up with Absolute Upholder, Absonite Upholder, and Finite Upholder, okay? You know, once you see the hierarchy, you know.
When you think of consummating destiny, I mean, that has the same kind of feeling to me as foresight and also perfectibility. And it's almost like, could this consummator of universe destiny, could it be the personality for this emerging absolute deity?
No, not quite, yeah. But you're getting close. Notice one way to kind of say what you were getting the hint of there is, there needs to be someone who sees the end from the beginning to a degree. Like when we're talking about trying to get the ultimate Trinity into existence. You've got all the supreme creators and the supreme being that are going to integrate into this. And so, well, who's sort of guiding them in? Who kind of knows how they have to fit in? You know, who sees the end from the beginning? Well, the architects do. Because the architects are already in the absonite. And so they can guide them from the finite into the absonite in just the proper way. They have the plan for how to do that. Okay? Take it up another notch. Okay? You know, if you're going to take God the Supreme and God the Ultimate, put them together as the Supreme Ultimate so that they can transcend, you know, the absonity, transcend the ultimate level. There has to be someone who is already there where that transcendence is going that can bring them in. There has to be a co-absolute being already in existence who can guide them in and connect them into what lies on the other side of him. That's the consummator of universe destiny. Just like the architects are absonite individuals, he's a co-absolute individual. He's the next notch up. Finite, absonite, co-absolute, co-infinite, you know, and then sort of the encompassing, you have the supreme and the ultimate and the absolute and the infinite. Think of co-absolute as the reality word, you know, as opposed to the deity word more. You know, like we try to, you know, you have deity and reality, and in that sense, you have finite and supreme, absonite and ultimate, co-absolute and absolute, co-infinite and infinite. You have these pairs that are sort of reality-deity pairs in the order I just said them. You know, you talk about seven levels of the absonite, so that you have that whole of absonity, you know, is just a reality, has this seven-level structure. But then the unification of that happens on four successive levels. That's why there's four outer space levels. There's four levels of the ultimate. That are bringing all of that absonity into some measure of unification. See, it's very complicated. You know, the finite is very simple. You just have the finite, and you have the one overarching, you know, of supremacy. That's, you know, bringing it all together, unifying all of the finite. And you can just extend this up a notch. See, once you see that, you know, you can just start to, it's like, well, if I figure it out here, let me take it up a notch. Let me take it up another notch. Let me take it all the way up and try to see if I can sort out the co-infinite and the infinite. You know, and once you've kind of, you know, got the juices flowing on this, you can actually begin to do that. You know, and that's what I was talking about. I mean, we're not going to try to do that here. That gets really complicated. Okay, but it can be done.
Jason's bummed out.
All right. Okay, let's get a little more here.
The ultimate Trinity is experientially unifying in completion, but we truly doubt the possibility of such full unification of the absolute Trinity. Our concept, however, of the eternal paradise Trinity is an ever-present reminder that deity trinitization may accomplish what is otherwise non-attainable. Hence, do we postulate the sometime appearance of the supreme ultimate and the possible trinitization factualization of God the Absolute.
And see, they're basically saying, okay, with my direct bottom-up, a lot higher than you and I, but still bottom-up extrapolation sort of sight, I just can't get there. How am I going to get God the Absolute? Well, you have to bring in the top-down that even you can't see. You know, and that's what they're saying. We can't directly see it, but logically we recognize the potential. You know, we have a logical mind. We can do just what I was saying. We can put that whole picture together all the way up to the co-infinite and the infinite, and we can see the logic of what's up there and how there can be a top down that can make what otherwise is impossible from a purely bottom-up point of view happen. That there's a unification potential that even their ability to sort of visualize how things can come together can't directly see, can't directly understand. But you can recognize and then interpret, and you can put it together. And they know, you know, see, so notice that they're sort of speaking so very definitively from those two viewpoints. Time viewpoint, no. How do they say that? But we truly doubt the possibility of... I mean, that's okay. And then they turn right around and with absolute certitude declare, you know, that God the Absolute is, you know, and can be. See, so that's... And they do that very upfront like that because they want you to do that. They want you to begin to allow just as definitive a top-down voice to speak within you and say, yeah, I know, little childlike self, I know you can't see that, but I can. It's okay. I see some end from the beginning. My personality has foresight, even though you as a self don't have foresight. I, as a personality, have foresight. I see a little bit of an end, a couple steps down the road, an end, you know, from your beginning. And it's okay. It can come together. Trust me. You know, that's, you know, you're beginning to master the self when you start to really have that conversation. Let, you know, the personality's connection to the big picture, to the cosmos, inform that self of how it can get to where it seems like it can't get to. I mean, how many times have you said, there's no way I'm going to survive tomorrow. It's impossible. There's no way that this is going to come together. And then 2 days later you go, well, dang it. Somehow or other, you know, the world is still in existence and I survived. And yeah, how many times have you experienced that? Why is that? You know, just, it's because... You know, what that little self can see is very limited. I mean, how many times do you have to repeat that before you go, you know, maybe I shouldn't get myself all bent out of shape every time it looks like there's no resolution from my self viewpoint? I mean, how many times does it take before I can learn by looking as well as by leaping? Or even not learning by leaping, leaping and leaping and leaping and still not learning. Okay? You know, every time, oh, it's the end again. There's no way I'm gonna be able to come through with what the job is demanding of me tomorrow or whatever, you know. No, well, it'll be okay. Okay, let's see, we got a whole, okay. All right.
Chris, I don't know if it's better to avoid this word, but whenever you say the word potential, I always think of the other side, the actual. And is there a reason why you're not talking about that?
Well, that's kind of, think about it. That's sort of what I was saying. One side, you know, is kind of in this potential mode and only believes, you know, when it's seen. And hence it's always doubting. On the other side has a hold of the actual. There's an actuality ahead of the current potentiality. It's like, you know, there's a potential that tomorrow is going to be okay. Yeah, but I doubt it. You know, see? No. Let the side that can see it. No, there's an actuality tomorrow. It's going to be okay. Know that. Don't always let that doubting, childish, it's not even childlike, really. When it gets in that mode, it's very childish to be constantly doubting the future. Where do you think tomorrow is going to, what crack is going to fall into? Where is it going to go? There's an infinite upholder. There's no edges. There's no cracks. Of course there's a tomorrow. But of course, if everyone believed that with absolute certitude that there's going to be a tomorrow, how would all the people who make their living off of, getting you to fear the existence of tomorrow make a living? How could they manipulate you? How could they demagogue you? Yeah, maybe we should stop being sophistry prone. Maybe we should start being sophistry proof. So that Michael and Gabriel think of us as real. Unlike those who were sophistry prone during the rebellion. And Gabriel said, those who are sophistry proof are not real. Okay? If you're not sophistry proof, you're not real. You want me to save that which doesn't exist? That's illogical. If you make yourself real, you're absolutely secure, but you've got to choose to be real. I can't hold that which doesn't exist. Make yourself sophistry proof. Stop being that doubting, limited self viewpoint.
Our concept, however, of the eternal paradise trinity mm-hmm. is an ever-present reminder that deity trinitization may accomplish what is otherwise non-attainable.
And that concept was alluded up front. It's more than just a bottom-up concept. It's also a top-down concept. Once you go, the Trinity is not just a consequence of the super-additive consequence of the relationship between the three that somehow magically came into existence in a way that I can't comprehend. I know it preceded the three, Then in a top-down viewpoint, you had this deity, and you pulled out of it the three parts that were individuatable, and what was left was the non-individuatable core, the Paradise Trinity. It was there, from that viewpoint, it was there before they were. The end was there before the beginning. That was the bottom-up viewpoint. Okay? Both are true. Both are true. Once you let go of the time viewpoint, once you put yourself, in a more eternal, even beyond time and eternity viewpoints, but an eternal viewpoint where it's just all right there and you're contemplating it. You're not just looking this direction or this direction or, you're just looking at it as a whole. An infinite eternal viewpoint. Yep.
This last paragraph is interesting when you consider the author. And they're saying these two things.
Yeah.
Well, I doubt it'll happen, but we've already seen a billion impossible things already happen. So of course it's going to happen.
And does he have
it's not a human mind.
No, right. It's a bottom-up mind.
Right.
He's a high mind, but he is solely a bottom-up mind. Within his mind, does he have that which came top-down and fundamentally is top-down? Does he have an adjuster in his mind? No, he does not. Does he have a catalyst for an increasingly clarifying and clarified top-down viewpoint in his mind? No, he does not. He has to go purely by what you have before you have the Spirit of Truth and a thought adjuster. All he has is the Holy Spirit, on his level. All he has is that reality response, that ability to recognize. Like I said, he can exercise faith and logical recognition. It's like, even though I can't see the end from the beginning, I recognize that there is this top down. So it's got to be somehow or other. Okay, but see, you have that potential. You have the Holy Spirit. You have the reality response. But you also have a thought adjuster and a catalyzing connection to that thought adjuster. Even if you're a seventh circler, you have a Spirit of Truth. And together, If you start to utilize the thought adjuster through the Spirit of Truth, you can start to have a definitive recognition of more than just, you know, the that it has to somehow be. You can begin to actually see what it is and understand what it is. You can begin to really think in the top-down viewpoint, not just have faith in it.
Well, he's also in the presence of the Father innumerable times.
As a bottom-up viewpoint.
So he's got some of the facts.
He's got, right. Yeah, like I pointed out, I mean, you know, when they're talking about God the Absolute, I mean, he's literally has direct experience with how absolute mind, you know, is fundamentally tied to infinite spirit, you know, and how you understand how that all hangs together. And so that's why he's saying, wow, and so this whole God the Absolute thing and the mindedness of God the Absolute, you know, when there isn't infinite spirit, I don't get how that can even work, because the only way that I understand how that absolute mind works is in relation to infinite spirit. Yeah. But at the same time, he can, you know, have this basic recognition of it conceptually, but he doesn't understand it in any sort of experiential way, and he doesn't have a catalyzer to help him to get a more definitive grip on that top-down view. It sort of is just there in that faith-like state for him.
Well, even a human being who came up from the first super universe and has gone to paradise and fused and all that has experienced the impossible happen enough times that they can say the otherwise unattainable in God, you know, it's a no-brainer.
Then a divine counselor is not an ascending being or a descending being. He's a stationary being. Again, he just has this very horizontal, stationary viewpoint. You know, he can look up, but he hasn't actually experienced moving up. You know, he hasn't. He'll. You know, he can't experience what you're going to immediately start experiencing as you start ascending. It's like, well, I don't need that those initial measures of faith anymore. I mean, I'm in direct engagement with this. I know this directly. I need faith for this higher stuff now. I mean, you're going to slowly be let going of all of the need for all kinds of faith and, you know, just basic Holy Spirit reality response recognition stuff, because, you know, you're not reaching up to it anymore. You know, it's right here in front of you. You know, spirit substance is this thing that I can bonk my head with. Okay, I don't have to have any faith that spirit substance exists. I mean, it's just right there, you know, and on up, you know. So just, you know, just as an ascending being, notice how much you have over him. That's why, remember how they tell you, a lot of times when they send beings out, they're out in pairs of perfect and perfected pairs, so that you have the two viewpoints together and they can complement each other, because, you know, it's like one eye and another eye, and together they're two eyes, you know, and they can see things three-dimensionally. But one without the other is pretty limited in its viewpoint. Yeah. All right, so that's last little paragraph here. What do we got?
The philosophers of the universes postulate a trinity of trinities, an existential experiential trinity infinite, but they are not able to envisage its personalization. Possibly it would equivalate to the person of the universal Father on the conceptual level of the I Am. But irrespective of all this, the original Paradise Trinity is potentially infinite, since the universal Father actually is infinite.
Okay, so there's that potentially infinite thing. See, tied to the Trinity again. Like I said, that's related to sifting through all the details of the co-infinite. And I mean, that's where they've taken us. Notice what they've done. They from the bottom-up viewpoint, you start with the Paradise Trinity, which is an individuality name. And then you have the ultimate Trinity and the absolute Trinity. And then you say, well, okay, and from that individuality viewpoint, I have three things, and I could imagine a trinity of trinities. Let's take the more definitive viewpoint of it. Instead of that sort of kind of kludged bottom-up viewpoint. Let's take a definitive top-down viewpoint. There are three trinities. There's the Trinity Infinite, the Trinity Absolute, and the Trinity Ultimate. You know, notice I flipped the words on the two. Not Ultimate Trinity and Absolute Trinity, but Trinity Absolute, Trinity Ultimate. Trinity Infinite, Trinity Absolute, Trinity Ultimate. That's the top-down view. There's just three. And you have these three components, like we just mentioned, from a bottom-up viewpoint, you understand when into the Trinity Ultimate and the Trinity Absolute. You have three components in the Trinity Infinite as well. You have the first experiential Trinity, the second experiential Trinity, and the Paradise Trinity. In the top-down viewpoint, the full top-down viewpoint, the Paradise Trinity isn't another Trinity. It's one of the components in one of the Trinities. Okay? You know, as well as the other two are also, you know, this is the first experiential, second experiential Trinity, and then the existential Trinity. Those are the three components of the Trinity Infinite. Okay? And just notice how it's just kind of staring you in the face. If I have, these absonite beings in the third position, that lowest Trinity, and I have the co-absolute being in the third position, the middle Trinity. If I go up to the Trinity Infinite, the third position, the Paradise Trinity, absonite, co-absolute, co-infinite. It's right there, just staring at me. All I have to do is just give it a name. You know, what's the next notch up? Co-infinite. And all this potentially infinite. See, potentially infinite is, it's not, from the beginning, engaged in infinite. It can come up and engage the infinite. That's what you mean by co-infinite. It's coming up from the bottom and engaging infinity. Just like coming up from the bottom and engaging the absolute, that's co-absolute, as opposed to just absolute from the top down. Co-absolute, absolute. Co-infinite, infinite. Yeah. All right. So that's where they leave you. Now, obviously, as a first reader, you know, you're lucky if you come away with the Trinity of Trinities, okay? But, that you remember that there was that term, the Trinity of Trinities. I remember reading that somewhere, you know? But we're trying to, notice that, there's a nice little synopsis of everything up here in the forward that is waiting there to be turn to. He's like, what's a really pithy way to say that again when I'm starting to think about the Paradise Trinity and the Trinity Infinite? The Paradise Trinity is potentially infinite. Yeah, that's how they worded that. You know, you can go back and you have a nice little touchstone on how some of these things can be said in a very simple way, because they're set up in the forward where a brand new reader would have to be reading them. And, it can't be beating reality, where it can get so dense that, your eyes glaze over even as an advanced reader, But, there's a subtle little clever condensation of that right up here in the foreword. All right. So there you have it. That's basically the foreword, except for the little epilogue here, the acknowledgement. And as soon as you start reading, you go, I can breathe again. suddenly the text is a lot more approachable. but we all know there's some great little points in here that are very, very important for especially a brand new reader, if not a longtime reader who hasn't kind of put the pieces together yet, about how to study the book. What exactly is this book? What am I trying to do in engaging it? And what are the sort of the basic facts behind the book, so I don't get myself off on a wrong tangent and then start stumbling over things that didn't meet my false preconceptions about what this is. So they're trying to help you with potential false preconceptions about studying the book here in this little acknowledgement. All right.
Acknowledgement. In formulating the succeeding presentations having to do with the portrayal of the character of the Universal Father and the nature of his paradise associates, together with an attempted description of the perfect central universe and the encircling seven superuniverses, we are to be guided by the mandate of the superuniverse rulers, which directs that we shall, in all our efforts to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge, give preference to the highest existing human concepts pertaining to the subjects to be presented. We may resort to pure revelation only when the concept of presentation has had no adequate previous expression by the human mind.
Okay, so two big things to pull out of there. The first is, what's the purpose of this revelation? And they're tying you back to the beginning of the foreword too. If you remember at the beginning of the second paragraph in the foreword, let's put the two together. The purpose of this revelation is to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge. And then flip back to this second paragraph in the beginning. Does anyone remember those things? In order to expand cosmic consciousness and enhance spiritual perception. That's the way to take the whole thing, what they say in the foreword, put it all together in one sentence. The purpose of this revelation is to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge in order to expand cosmic consciousness and enhance spiritual perception. Period. And it's like, well, okay. No. Think about it precisely. It doesn't say the purpose is to reveal facts. It says the purpose is to reveal truth. Okay, but you can't reveal truth on figment. So there has to be coordinated essential knowledge. By and large, they can't reveal facts, especially near facts that we can figure out. So sometimes there's going to be an issue in play there. They've got to use the facts as we currently have them, despite their, warts. But they're going to reveal truth in spite of the warts on the facts. So be careful when you're reading. Be discerning. Know how this works. Know how they've used facts. There's no errors in the book, but they are using limited facts at times. So you have to appreciate that. If you think no, the purpose of this book is to reveal absolute facts with absolute certainty. If you go in a full absolutism mode, a fundamentalist sort of a mode with it, you're going to have nothing but problems. Okay. Matter of fact, your life of the revelation is going to be very short-lived, because if you have any intelligence, that's quickly going to turn you from a truth seeker into an error seeker, and you're going to be an error finder as soon as you are an error seeker. And it's going to be nothing but error, or so it seems. Okay, no. That's, you've chosen to rationalize it, interpret it thus. You haven't recognized before you interpreted. If you recognize the truth, then you'll have a proper interpretation, a truthful interpretation, not an erroneous one. And everyone says, look, I found an error. No, you don't have a proper recognition, therefore you've found error, okay? The error is not in the book, the error is between your ears, okay? Error does not exist objectively. Error is a subjective thing. You've given untruth form in your mind. If you want to fix that, you need to stop doing that. Stop giving untruth form in your mind. Give truth form in your mind. And then you'll have a different relationship with the revelation. And it has nothing to do with rationalizing the book. It has to do with recognizing first, before you do any rational thought, any interpretation. You have to recognize truth. Because not only, like you've heard me say many times, I can't give you truth. Truth is not knowledge. It's not because I'm just this lowly little finite being. No revelator can just give you truth. This revealing truth thing is a very tricky process. He can reveal he can give you coordinated essential knowledge directly, because it's knowledge. It's knowingness that can be given. That's what knowledge means, knowingness that can be given. You can know truth, but it's not knowledge. It's not a knowingness that can be given. The truth that I know, I cannot give to you. But I could try to set up favorable conditions where you could recognize the same truth that I've recognized. And coordinated essential knowledge is a very helpful component of that. Very favorable condition to have the facts in the proper coordination. Okay, now try to thread something through that. Don't take your discombobulated facts and try to thread something through it, because only error is threaded through figment. You can't get truth through figment. You have to have fact, then you can have truth. Okay, so that's there.
They did a great job of scrubbing out the figment.
Remember what they tell you, the authoritative elimination of error, you know, is part of what's going on in the revelatory mandate. And then that last part. Part of the mandate is to give preference to the highest existing human concepts. Okay? We may resort to pure revelation only when. Okay? How many longtime readers have not let that sink in yet? Okay? If they can find anyone who has said something adequately, they have to use those words before they can pen their own sentence in a pure revelatory fashion. That's part of the mandate. It tells you right up front here. Okay? And so, you know, they're looking for Jesus to say that, you know, the words that they express the truth of what Jesus said in a nice pithy way. Especially if they're in a mode where they're kind of condensing things and stuff. They're not going to take the Aramaic or whatever he was saying, transcribe it into English, and put those English words down in the book. If the Apostle Paul at some point had a really great little sentence that expressed that truth, that in that discourse Jesus said, you know, in 12 sentences, you know, they're not going to translate those 12 sentences from Aramaic into English. They're going to take Paul's nice little pithy expression of that truth and put it in there. You know, and it'll be in quotes, and it'll say, Jesus said, quote unquote, and you're going, no, even I know enough of the Bible to know that that's in Corinthians, and that was written by Paul. Okay? Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I get it. The purpose of the revelation is to reveal truth, not facts, and so quotations are quotations of truth, not quotations of fact. He didn't literally say that, or the Bible, you know, there's a Bible quote, almost never. Is there a factual Bible quote? But there's always a truthful Bible quote. You know, they're showing you the truth behind those words in the Bible, quote unquote. Okay? The truth is quoted, not the fact. It's like, well, I don't like that. It's like, well, that's part of the challenge of the fifth epical revelation. Can you start to be a truth seeker? That's what a truth seeker is looking for, truth. Not a fact finder is looking for quotes of fact and numbers of fact and things. You know, that's a fact finder. That's not a truth seeker. But you're not going to somehow have truth with your eyes closed to fact. It's not blind truth, quote unquote. You know, it's not belief, you know, it's not, you know, an opiate of the masses. Okay? Can you really discover what truth really is and how truth has this separateness from fact and yet a dependence on, you know, fact, how they're actually related? And so how they had to construct this book with this revelatory mandate where they can't tell you something that you're going to figure out in 10 years, just simple factually. But there's a truth tied to that that they need to reveal, because there's no way you can figure that out yourself. So they've constructed it very carefully. So you can do that if you challenge yourself up front, knowing that you've got this potential for distortion of meaning if you start thinking of things too simplistically. And you're going to start to stumble over your false initial assumptions.
I've always thought that when they use the word concept, and we'll get into it again in the next paragraph, that, you know, some little old Chinese girl in the 15th century is out in the garden and is talking to herself about something. that's a human concept that she's expressing to herself.
Sure, it's totally possible. It doesn't have to all be written.
Right. Okay. Well, I didn't say written. I mean,
or even vocalized. Right. I mean,
it's an idea, an idea put together with an ideal is part of the human consciousness.
Right. The point is, and like I said, we're going to get it a little more in the next one. I mean, the point is, if humans have engaged the cosmos, if they've created a distillation of the cosmos in a certain way, even if it's totally in the mind. Work with that rather than you saying, no, distill it like I do. And so they're told that they have to use the way humans distill the cosmos as much as they can, unless it just is totally, fogged up. And then they can say, well, let's do it this way. But of course, even when they do it their way, they're trying to do it as much our way as they can.
And the value of that is because it's evolution.
Right, because the book has to be evolutional. Not revolutional.
Yeah.
There are many things in here when you recognize them will be revolutionary. But the way it was done was not revolutional, maybe revolutionary to you, but the way they did it was evolutional, not revolutional. Because if they do it in a revolutional fashion, that's called rebellion, okay? They do it in an evolutional fashion. It's not an evolutionary process, so much. I mean, this book didn't evolve out of the dust, but it's an evolutional construct. So that difference between evolutional and evolutionary, revolutional and revolutionary, you need to reflect on those differences between those two adjectives. So it's done in an evolutional fashion so that it meets you where you are, as you are, as much as possible. Because to do otherwise, is to be in rebellion. And that's what rebellion is. Saying, oh, skip all that, where you are and as you are. Let's just jerk you up, No, that's rebellion.
And it seeks to elevate our minds.
Yeah. Evolutionally, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the Urantia book isn't the last word. And that when people concretize the teachings of the Urantia book, I mean, it seems like we're in danger of the same thing that we observe or we criticize when people take the Bible and want to make every word of the Bible, the word of God.
Right. Two things, just real quickly, two things. You got a whole paper on the epical revelations. There's a whole normal sequence of epical revelations. We haven't had a magisterial son yet. We haven't had any Trinity teacher sons yet. Even our bestowal son couldn't really do his whole job because he jumped ahead of the magisterial son. We got a lot of epical revelation in store for us yet. Never mind, every one of us, we have an adjuster inside of us. There's auto-revelatory potential. Now, of course, you got to be careful. All know there's danger there. Start listening to voices in your head and calling them the adjuster. But yeah, there's all kinds of revelation, in play, in the past, now, and in the future. Successive, revelation. Okay, so let's go to the next paragraph here.
Successive planetary revelations of divine truth invariably embrace the highest existing concepts of spiritual values as a part of the new and enhanced coordination of planetary knowledge. Accordingly, in making these presentations about God and His universe associates, we have selected as the basis of these papers more than 1,000 human concepts representing the highest and most advanced planetary knowledge of spiritual values and universe meanings. Wherein these human concepts, assembled from the God-knowing mortals of the past and the present, are inadequate to portray the truth as we are directed to reveal it, we will unhesitatingly supplement them, for this purpose drawing upon our own superior knowledge of the reality and divinity of the paradise deities and their transcendent residential universe.
Just one little thing to add to that, it isn't, might not be immediately obvious. The simplest place to see this being done, the unhesitatingly supplementing, is take a Bible quote, okay? You know, it's in quotes in the book. It's obviously a quote out of the Bible, you know, and go find it in the Bible. I mean, almost never is it just verbatim out of any translation of the Bible. Because it could always use a little coordination, okay? And they've unhesitatingly inserted a word or changed a word, you know? And they're going, well, how dare you change the sacred text, you know? No, they will unhesitatingly, because it's not a sacred text, okay? They will unhesitatingly modify a word or something in that Bible quote so that it's coordinated essential knowledge now. They've done that. And they've done the same thing with lots of other human source works besides the Bible. You know, they've taken what they could and as directly as they could and unhesitatingly added or modified what they needed so that it was a reasonable coordination of essential knowledge, you know, of where you are now, and then they can build on that. You know, and if that means taking a book with 20 chapters and using 15 of the chapters and rearranging the order of them so that we do chapter 15 first, and then, you know, they've done that. You know, because it's like if you think about it in this order, you'll find it works better for you. You'll have more favorable conditions in play than the way the human author laid it out. This is what they've done. Okay? It's not plagiarism, that's a fact finder notion. Okay? Yeah, they've told you right here, point blank. I mean, how much more direct can it be? Okay, just not, you know, this is what they've done. It's an evolutional construct. Okay, and if you just can't countenance that, well, then close the book and go somewhere else. Okay, this is what the book is.
The other feature of that unhesitating is if you take all of that coordinated human knowledge and you look how they did it, and you put all that aside, you'd say, okay, we've got, you know, 25% of the book, or 75%, of whatever the heck it is. But then they say, okay, that's a foundation. That's what you thought before. Mm-hmm. This is a revelation. We're going to lay something on top of that. There's a bunch of new stuff that you haven't even ever considered.
Right, because a lot of times...
That's a lot of unhesitating...
Right. A lot of times, there's no way that we can ever get our hands on those facts. So there's no revelatory constraint in play. They can just tell it to us. And that's the amazing thing. You know, all of us have talked about this many times. We know that, you know, in a lot of ways, we're still in the second, you know, dispensation mode where you only have it up to the most highs. And look at what we've got in front of us here. All the way up to paradise and beyond. I mean, we just were talking about the co-infinite, for Christ's sake. Okay? I mean, how far is that beyond the most highs? It's right here in front of us. So, you know, that's where, you know, some of the amazing stuff lies is, you know, where they have just given you a bunch of facts because you can't get at those facts either anytime soon or never, you know? And so they're there. All right, let's get the last paragraph in here.
We are fully cognizant of the difficulties of our assignment. We recognize the impossibility of fully translating the language of the concepts of divinity and eternity into the symbols of the language of the finite concepts of the mortal mind. But we know that there dwells within the human mind a fragment of God, and that there sojourns with the human soul the spirit of truth. And we further know that these spirit forces conspire to enable material man to grasp the reality of spiritual values and to comprehend the philosophy of universe meanings. But even more certainly, we know that these spirits of the divine presence are able to assist man in the spiritual appropriation of all truth, contributory to the enhancement of the ever-progressing reality of personal religious experience, God consciousness.
Amen.
And read that.
Indicted by an Overton Divine Counselor, Chief of the Corps of Super Universe Personalities, assigned to portray on your rancher the truth concerning the Paradise Deities and the Universe of Universes.
Okay, now that last paragraph, you know, we basically said that, you know. I want you to just note one neat little thing that's thrown in at the very end. Is a definition of God consciousness. Did you notice that? No. It's much more than that. Okay, look at the whole thing. Are able to assist man in God consciousness. To assist man in the spiritual appropriation of all truth contributory to the enhancement of the ever-progressing reality of personal religious experience. That's God consciousness. And wow, that's a mouthful and a headful. That's very purposeful, that it's not some simple, oh, yeah, okay, personal religious experience, okay, I got that God consciousness thing. It's like, no, what did that even say? You know, you've got to stop and parse that. That's what they want you to do. They don't want you to have an easy out, something that you can think you can easily label God consciousness. Ah, been there, done that. They want you to take your notion of God up a notch. The spiritual appropriation of all truth contributory to the enhancement of the ever-progressing reality of personal religious experience. And if you can figure out what all those parts are referring to, then maybe you're getting some handle on God consciousness. Okay? God consciousness is something that's encompassing. Oh, and we forgot to mention that. I just reminded myself. Remember back when we were talking about the encompassing word? You know? If you start with the Trinity Infinite, encompassing the Absolute Upholder. And the Trinity Absolute, encompassing the Absentite Upholder. And the Trinity Ultimate, encompassing the Finite Upholder. You have this very definite... See, in that mode, it's all clear. You have an encompassing in that which is encompassed. Remember when we were talking earlier, I was like, it was a little bit confusing when you're thinking it just bottom up. It's like, okay, if there's this substrate of these two trinities when you're up there in those higher levels, how come there isn't a substrate down here? How come there isn't some trinity below the finite, you know, that we're building on? And it's like, well, I guess we're kind of just, maybe we don't need one or something. And I even kind of said it that way because I didn't want to get into it too deep. See, the way you really resolve that is top down. You know, it's wrapped around and then it's, you know, so that there's a womb. Okay? That's how it's done. It's done top down. And they're encouraging that here in just in this end. I mean, for you to begin to really have a God consciousness that encompasses something instead of just being some little notion you've got floating around in your head, something that wraps around all of that. Okay? Matter, mind, spirit, personality, all of the cosmic harmony of all that, wraps around all of that. That's what you're looking for. All right. There we have it. Yep. Yeah.
That line right there really, really did it for me. Just what I'm thinking of as a new reader from the book was these spirit forces conspire to enable material man to grasp the reality of spiritual values and to comprehend the philosophy of universe meanings. And I see the difference in grasp versus comprehend. Mm-hmm. You know.
And they conspire. But you can thwart that conspiracy, that divine conspiracy within you. You know, if you don't supply the favorable conditions, it doesn't matter how much there's a divine conspiracy within it, it has no effect. You've said no. You've given it no space. You have to supply it a space to be. You know, the spirit of truth and the thought adjuster have to be somewhere. There has to be a domain that you create for them within. That's a relationship with the Holy Spirit. If you have to do that first. First, you create a relationship with the Holy Spirit. That creates a domain. It gives you the capacity for a relationship with them. They have to be somewhere. There has to be a temple within. The adjuster can only live in a temple within. Okay? And so if you have no relationship to the Holy Spirit, there can be no place for it to come. That's why by grace alone, you're given an initial tiny little temple, which most people are blissfully ignorant of. They're down here floating around. They've never even gone to that little temple, let alone get up in there and go, you know, this place could be improved by making it a little bigger. Now, why don't we grow this a little bit? Why don't I take delight in cultivating a relationship with the Holy Spirit and expand my temple?
And who's this little raisin of a self that's been crunched in?
Yeah. That's called an adjuster, you know, with a straitjacket on. Yeah. Right.
They do say it's confined.
Yes. Imprisoned. Yes. All right. Let's take a moment here and let's take a moment and just kind of let it settle in a little.